Colorado Division of Unemployment and Training versus Accord Human Resources. Let me advise everybody that Justice Marquez will not be participating in this argument. So we're set for an hour argument, half hour each side. You have to keep track of your time. And I ask that each of you, when you start your argument, would you please state your name so we can keep the record. Are both parties ready? Please proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Katie Allison, attorney registration number 39430, appearing on behalf of the Division of Employment and Training. Your Honors, the Single Employing Unit Statute 870-114 provides the Division with the authority to combine tax accounts of commonly owned entities. I will address the arguments for why this provision provides the Division with this authority in the following order. First, the plain language of the Single Employing Unit Statute clearly provides the Division with this authority. Second, applying the Single Employing Unit Statute is fair to all employers. And third, the Single Employing Unit Statute applies for all purposes of the Act, not just for benefit purposes. I first want to take a look at the statute in question. In this case, the Single Employing Unit Statute basically says that all individuals performing services for any of Accord's entities in Colorado shall be deemed to be employed by one single entity for all purposes of the Act. So Accord Human Resources and Accord Human Resources Colorado were two entities that were performing services in Colorado. This statute says that both entities should be taxed as one single employing unit. And I have a diagram, if it's okay with the court, to help describe how experience ratings sort of work. Is that okay?
Why don't you approach and pass it out?
I just have a poster.
Shown that to opposing counsel?
I showed it to him a little bit beforehand.
Have any objection to her?
Yes, Your Honor. Substitute representations that whatever is presented here is actually in the record, and an opportunity perhaps for me to look at it in more detail before I argue if I find it necessary.
But all right. I will certainly give you permission to argue it. Do you have a copy of that you can give to opposing counsel?
I don't. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Well, I think we'll just let's skip it and go ahead with your argument.
Right. Basically, unemployment taxes are calculated using three main ideas. There's more to it than this, but the three main ones are: one, the number of employees that an employer employs; two, is a chart at 876-103 that basically fluctuates based on how much money is in the unemployment fund currently; and number three is the benefits charged against an account, and that's basically when an employee is laid off, and then the employee applies for benefits. Those benefits will be charged against the employer's account, and that will increase the employer's account rating. So in this case, Accord had two accounts. Well, it had more than two, but two of its accounts were Accord HR and Accord HR Colorado. And it had an experience rating attributable to those accounts as separate experience ratings. Now, when the Division goes to combine accounts into a single employing unit, it basically takes those two ratings, those two accounts, and it accounts for the history in both of them. So it takes the first entity's rating, and then it just adds in the rate, the benefits charged, and whatever else has happened in the account's history of the second account. Okay, so it creates sort of this fair accounting of what has gone on through the entire history of these two accounts and combines it into one rate. Okay, what can happen is in some instances, this rate will actually benefit the employer. And I might get into more of how that works, but you can see in this case why the single employing unit statute is important. A court had these two separate accounts, and it was able to transfer its employees to the account with the lower rate. And in doing so, it avoided paying nearly $450,000 in unemployment taxes. And there are two major problems here. First is the obvious. This creates a $450,000 shortfall to the unemployment fund. But the more important problem is what this means to other Colorado employers. The math is simple. $450,000 less into the fund is $450,000 more that other Colorado employers have to make up.
Because this is no state money, basically. It's the employer's money that's put in a special account. Just tell me how that works.
Okay. Yes, when... I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
Yeah, just explain basically how the unemployment insurance fund works. Is it wholly funded by employers?
I believe...
You're talking about a direct one-for-one assessment on other employers for less taxes coming in here. I just want to understand how it works.
Okay, good question. I don't believe it's totally one-for-one funded by employers. I believe the federal government also contributes to the state unemployment fund if we're complying with certain federal rules. So there's federal money coming in, but it is the chart that I was explaining in 876-103. The rates in that chart basically go up and down based on how much money is in the fund, and those are the rates that directly determine how much an employer will be paying in unemployment taxes. So less money in the fund, in that sense, it's maybe not one for one, but less money in the fund does mean more money for other Colorado employers. Did that answer your question?
That helps.
Okay.
But you're representing that the total number of dollars reduced because of this is directly charged to other employers. I mean, that's what you're saying.
Yes, that's correct.
All right. Secondly, now, obviously, corporate law allows entities to set up different corporations, and apparently that's what we have here.
Right.
But you're saying the legislature explicitly has a statute that makes it one employer for the purposes of this unemployment program.
That's exactly right. It's absolutely fine for entities to set up multiple corporate forms, but it just makes sense in this case, in unemployment tax purposes, for them to be combined into one unemployment tax rate for all of their entities.
Okay, so is this a frequent occurrence where the agency audits to see whether employers are trying to escape their tax liability, or is this the first time this has occurred?
The division frequently audits employers. An example is to see whether, one of the things they look at is to see whether the employer is correctly stating whether they have independent contractors versus employees. So they basically have a checklist when they're going through an audit. Is this employer correctly saying, representing their workers, misclassifying or not? Is this employer, should it be combined with other entities to one unemployment tax account rate because they're all commonly owned and directed? So it's one of the things that they look at in there.
So this is you're saying this is a routine practice of the agency to do this under the scope of its authority.
Right, it is. I do think that this case, a court, and another case that is in the courts now, were the two main ones where the division really suspected that they had intentionally tried to avoid paying their taxes. In other cases, they've combined entities into a single employing unit, but this was the one where they did it really thinking that there was bad intent going on. And what I said earlier is sometimes when they combine these entities, the tax rate, it actually benefits the employers. If the employer hasn't intentionally moved employees to the lower rate, it can actually, combining them, takes into account all of the history, and it can actually benefit the employers.
Thank you.
Her representation is the department combines without regard to what the bottom line is, that is, whether it ends up meaning more or less money into the fund.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Yes.
Sawson, in the reply brief, you make some arguments about SUTA and how this statute is not directly related at the problem that SUTA was passed to address that I kind of didn't quite get. Could you explain that again?
Sure. The SUTA, first of all, the SUTA language was implemented. The federal government recognized this practice was going on, and they decided that they wanted to require states to implement some language to prevent SUTA dumping. And Colorado implemented that in 2005 at 876.104. And it implemented it because it was required to do so in the first place. But really what I see, part of the difference between this new SUTA statute and the single employing unit statute that applies to this case is the new SUTA statute is in the taxing statutes. In this case, the single employing unit statute is in the definitional statutes. It's under 870.114, and Article 70 is the definitional statutes of the Colorado Employment Act. So the way I see it is the single employing unit statute, and it still exists. It coexists with the new SUTA language. I believe that the single employing unit statute is basically the definitional statute, and the taxing statutes, the new SUTA language, is basically how you implement it.
I thought the point you were making in the brief, and this is what confused me, was that SUTA is really directed to when a company buys out another company, as opposed to the problem here where a company that is owned by a larger group splits off into different corporate organizations. And you were making that distinction, which I didn't quite get.
Right, I understand what you're saying. I think the SUTA language focuses mostly on that.
On what?
On, for example, when an employer can just buy out another employer just to get the tax rating. One employer could be a butcher, and the other employer is a dry cleaner. And the dry cleaner wants the butcher's tax rating, so they buy that company out and get the low tax rating. That is what I think a lot of SUTA is intended to target. But I was reviewing this in preparation for argument, and I see what you're saying. I do think that there is language in the new SUTA statute that applies to this situation.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. The Court of Appeals agreed that Accord was entitled to only one account, but only for unemployment benefit purposes, not unemployment tax purposes. This holding simply ignores the statute, and it doesn't make sense. The statute says that the Accord entities are entitled to only one unemployment tax account for all purposes of the Act. The legislature could not have been any clearer on this point. It specifically states that it applies for all purposes of the Act, not just for benefit purposes.
Can I just ask you a question about that? I think I understand your argument, but why can't it be for one for benefit purposes, but if it's for taxing purposes, it has to be strictly construed? So liberal on one hand, but strictly construed against the government because it's a taxing statute, when it's used as a taxing statute. What's wrong with that kind of thinking?
The real problem is that you basically, what I was showing you earlier is you have two accounts, right? Or more. But when you are looking at these for just benefit purposes and you combine them, then you end up with the combined rating accounting for all the experience of both accounts. Now if you then do it differently for tax purposes, you get only one of those accounts ratings. Okay, so say combined they're 3.2 and just one of them is 2.5. Okay, so you have two different accounts here. You're basically taking money out of the fund at the 2.5 rate or one of the rates, and you're putting money back into the fund or the opposite at the 3.8 rate.
That explains the effect, but I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, I mean, whether it really makes any sense to take a statute and for one purpose construe it in a particular way, strictly, and for another purpose construe it in a separate way because of liberal construction. In other words, taking a construction principle and arriving at two different meanings for the same statutory language.
Right. I would have to think a little bit more about that in terms of, on a general sense, but I think in this sense, no. I think the single employing unit statute is in the definitional statutes. The definitional statutes define employing unit, and then the very next sentence is the single employing unit statute. It defines single employing unit. And I think you have to look over to the tax statutes to understand how this all works. And the tax statutes say, 876.103 says that an employer newly subject to CESA and is an employer who never at any time has had an account. And that's exactly what happened in this case. Accord was already an employer. So any further accounts that it had, the division went back and basically denied those accounts and then combined the experience, the history of that account into the first account. So the taxing statute describes how this all works. The definitional statute, the single employing unit statute, provides the authority to do it.
I think the question goes a little bit deeper to the objective of the tax statutes. Now, generally, isn't it true that our strict definition of the taxing statute has to do with the power to exercise tax on income or sales, things like that? This seems to be a special kind of arrangement for a certain purpose. Of course, it's a tax, it's a levy of some sort by the government, but it has to do with the fund and the purposes of this fund and who it's administered for, and that is workers who have been laid off from employment. And both the state and the federal government have determined to participate in a program that provides some relief while people look for other employment. So should we be looking at a different rubric of construction when we look at an integrated program like this instead of just a general rubric of tax law, tax construction? I think that may be the question. So what's your response to that? Of course, I'm going to address that to your opposing counsel as well.
I still think that the single employing unit statute should be kept in its box of the definitional statute, and that the taxing statutes should be used to describe how you actually combine the units. But
so it's just the implementation of the broader scheme.
Right. That's how I see this. And you're exactly right that what we're hoping to do here is to allow for people to be able to get unemployment benefits, and to do that we need money going into the fund.
Yeah, and this is an employment at will state, and therefore employers are generally authorized to discharge employees when they figure they don't need them, right? I mean,
right. And if you look at the amicus's example in their opening brief, where they talked about a call center and how they wanted to have their entity be able to separate the call center part of their entity from the rest of their entity because the call center had a high turnover rate. Well, being able to separate that just absolutely goes against the purpose of the fund, which is to prevent people from being laid off and preventing companies from being able to just separate the parts of their companies that they want to have a high, or that are going to have a high risk rate. Your Honors, the Industrial Claim Appeals Office agreed that this statute applies for all purposes of the Act, not just benefit purposes. And reviewing courts should give deference to that finding, as it was the final agency action in this case. This case is really that simple. So far, all courts have essentially agreed that the single employing unit statute authorizes the division to combine accounts. The extension to be made is that the division has the authority to do so for all purposes of the act, as the act states. And I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Brian Nugent, counsel for Accord, Carlisle Bar number 35620. To my left at council table is Jacqueline Casey with the firm of Rothberger, Johnson & Lyons. I will be handling the argument on behalf of Appley today. This case is about what Section 870-114 actually says. And it also is about what it does not say. We can engage in reasonable debate with respect to various terms stated in the sentence at issue, but there is no reasonable debate as to what the statute is missing. It is missing words necessary to authorize the division's specific actions taken in this case. Those actions were the combining of five separately and legally established employer accounts for the purpose of assessing a tax. In the end, that is what the division claims the words of 870-114 gives it authority to do. Those words are simply absent. As noted by the Court of Appeals, the statute assumes a pre-existing employing unit. In other words, one employing unit that maintains two or more establishments for which an individual provides services. The statute does not provide a mechanism for the division to, in essence, create that one employing unit. And that's what they have done. The division combined five separate employer accounts that had, four of which had been doing business in the state of Colorado for quite some time, had each been assigned their own discrete and distinct employer account because they each met the definition provided by the General Assembly as to what constitutes an employer. They paid taxes according to the rates assigned to them. As held by the hearing officer and the Court of Appeals.
Would you just point out that statutory definition of employer? I'm looking for it here.
The statutory definition of an employer is any employing unit, and says that after December 31st, 1998, paid wages of $1,500 or more during any calendar quarter, or employed at least one individual in employment for some portion of the day on each of 20 days during the calendar year. So in essence, it is an employing unit, but it also has to fulfill additional acts. So you could have an, also it's important to remember under the statute, there are certain types of services that aren't considered employment at all. So you could be an employing unit that has certain services provided for it and not be an employer, because there is no employment being provided for you, domestic help.
So there is no definition of employer.
Yes, there is. It's stated in the statute that says it is an employing unit.
Okay.
That paid at least $1,500 of wages during a calendar quarter, or employed at least one individual in employment for at least 20 days. So there is a definition. And as the Court of Appeals and the hearing officer found very clearly, and it is not a fact in dispute in this case, each of the Accord entities met that definition. Now, under Section 876-103, the division is required by the General Assembly to assign to each employing unit that meets that definition its own separate account. In essence, if you meet that definition, you're entitled to a separate employment account. And what's important today is the distinction between what is within the province of the General Assembly and what is the responsibility of the division. It is the General Assembly's duty to create the structure by which it deems best after public hearing to create and maintain an unemployment system. It is the division's responsibility to follow what the General Assembly has actually said. The General Assembly has decided that the most efficient and equitable way to allocate the tax burden on employers is by employer, not employer groups, not groups of employing unions, but by employer. The policy for that is that, contrary to the argument the division makes that it is somehow unfair, that system is actually fair because each employer rests and falls based upon its particular ability to hire, maintain employees, and avoid turnover. If it does well, it is rewarded with a favorable rate. If it does poorly, it receives a higher rate. That is fair. But what's most important, it is what the General Assembly has decided for the structure. It is not the division's job to undo that. In essence, that is what the division is seeking to do through 870-114. In the end, based upon the interpretation advanced by the division, how would any business owner know that its separate employer accounts, each assigned a rate because it met the definition of employer, were susceptible to a higher tax rate because of being combined at a later date and retroactively? A fair notice of that consequence is simply not present in 870-116. Interestingly, and it is important to note, that if the facts of this case occurred today, there would be a very different result, and we would likely not be here. Subsequent to the facts giving rise to this case, and prior to the issue of the liability determination, the General Assembly acted quite specifically to address the transfer of assets and payroll between commonly owned and controlled entities. In 2005, it amended Article 76, which is the tax part of the statute, and provided clear notice to Colorado employers. The amendment warned that if there's a transfer of payroll between commonly owned or controlled employer accounts, there will be tax consequences.
Well, why isn't that just a clarification of what the Assembly had considered the law to be previously?
First of all, when this statute was first enacted, the statute contained a definition of employer that had in it language that allowed for and permitted the combining of employing units if there was common ownership or control. That was in the statute, and that is discussed in the Teach versus Leach case cited in brief. In 1941, the Colorado legislature repealed what is referred to as the affiliation clause. In other words, it removed all reference to commonly owned entities, employer accounts, or the combining of them, removed it, and never put it back in the statute until 2005. In 2005, following the lead of Congress, it addressed the activity that it deemed to be objectionable, which was the transfer of payroll in a way to seek a lower employment rate. That is now fair notice to Colorado employers that if you have commonly owned entities, even if they have their own accounts, and a transaction occurs that includes the transfer of payroll, the unemployment rate of the predecessor must transfer to the successor, and if there's a finding that it was done for the purpose solely or primarily to seek to obtain a lower rate, the accounts are subject to combining. That language has not been in the statutes since prior to 1941. It is clear and it is fair. It puts employers like Accord on fair notice that despite how they may want to organize their corporations and engage in certain transactions, there could be certain tax consequences. At the end of the day, that is all we are arguing here today, is that that type of notice, that kind of language, is simply not present in section.
Mr. Dirgin, I have two questions. One is at the onset of this argument that you're making now, I think you said the result would have been different.
Yes, sir.
In what way?
Because in 2004, when Accord transferred or had a transaction between Accord HR and Accord Colorado for purposes of securing workers' compensation insurance, the successor rules at that time allowed for that transfer. In fact, the division abandoned its argument that that transaction somehow violated the successor rules. However, in 2005, the legislature said, no, if there's commonality, there's common ownership, and that type of transaction occurs, the rate must follow. So the rate would have had to have followed from Accord HR to Accord Colorado, and there would have been no issue with respect to the taxes paid. And we submit there would have been no issue. And certainly, Accord would have made the economic decision that said, why would we fight this? Because the law says that's
what happened. You mean the difference would be that Accord would pay instead of contest? Is that what you're saying?
No, the difference would be Accord would be on notice that a law was in effect that required the result that the division seeks in this case without such a law, and therefore would not have challenged it.
I understand.
The issue is that there was fair notice in 2005.
Well, the second question is, why isn't 870.114 fair notice?
Because as noted by the hearing officer and the Court of Appeals, nowhere in that statute is there any language that authorizes the combining of separate employer accounts. It is simply not there. And in nowhere in it are there any tax consequences discussed whatsoever.
I see. I'm stumbling over that middle sentence in that paragraph that Justice Martinez just cited that talks about single shall be deemed to be employed by single employing unit for all purposes of 70 to 82. What do we do with that?
Respectfully, the same thing that the Court of Appeals did, which is recognize that for all purposes, first recognize that there are no taxing provisions in the statute. This is a tax case, and it must be strictly construed. To answer
but question, well, I hear that,
about that issue.
I hear that, but that, that levy has to do with this statute and this program, does it not?
I'm sorry, which levy?
The tax levy that your client is objecting to has to do with the total scheme, the design, the legislative design of the statute.
Understood. And I believe what is the crux of the argument from the division is the phrase, for all purposes.
Yes.
In other words, for all purposes, why doesn't it mean taxes as well as benefits? Understood. Particularly since this is a tax case, for all purposes, what the division wants to do is substitute for all purposes for words that actually authorize the combining of employer accounts. What the Court of Appeals and the hearing officer recognized was A, they're not the same. For all purposes, for instance, the way to read the statute, in our opinion, would be if you started with for all purposes, an individual that works for one employing unit, remember, a pre-existing employer unit, not one the division creates. For one employing unit that maintains two or more establishments may be deemed employed by a single employing unit. What the Court of Appeals and the hearing officer recognizes is that the only way to apply that sentence in harmony with the rest of the statute is for benefits. And the statute does speak directly to individuals, not tax effects, not tax consequences, nor the combining of any employer accounts. Applied to benefits and all purposes available to an individual, only individuals can seek benefits. They don't pay taxes. Applying to benefits does no harm to the rest of the statute, in particular, the careful statutory structure built by the General Assembly that says, if you're an employer, you shall have your own account, and all wages, taxes, and benefits shall be reported per that employer account. Until the General Assembly changes that structure, this sentence cannot be read in harmony with those mandates. And we believe that's what the Court of Appeals...
Explain to me why it is disharmonious with the taxing provision, but not with the benefit provision.
Because in order to make a claim for benefits, when someone goes out... And a good example would be someone who makes a claim for benefits works for two establishments for a period of time. Let's say works for one for 5 years, works for the last one for 3 weeks. When the person goes to make a claim for benefits, that person makes a claim for benefits, presumably against its last employer, if it was within the period of time applicable. Without this sentence, that person could be left with a claim based only on 3 weeks. That would not be fair, and that is not the intent of the legislature. That claim could then include the employment from the other establishments. And in doing so, it has no effect whatsoever on the structure of how taxes are collected, are imposed and collected. In other words, there's no combining of employer accounts. There's no... there's no issue with the mandate in 876.103 that says the division shall assign an account to each employer. By applying it to benefits, there is harmony. It works. And in essence, that's what every court who's ever looked at this case has said. Contrary to what the division has stated, there has not been a case that we can find that has ever applied 870-114 or anything similar to it for the purpose of combining separate employer accounts in order to assess the tax. No case. And we submit that this court should not do that either.
Let me ask you a question, Mr. Nugent. Justice Martinez raised the point that we're basically taking the same words in a statute, and for one purpose interpreting them liberally, and for the other we're interpreting them strictly, which seems like a pretty strange principle. So how do you get around that?
Two, maybe three points in response. First, this court in 1944, in the Teach versus Leach case, cited in brief, did precisely that. In that case, there was a definition that was the issue, the definition of employer. The definition is in the definitional section. But what this court stated was, because there is an effort to impose a tax, we must treat that part of the statute being used to impose a tax, as a taxing statute, and we must strictly construe it in favor of the taxpayer. That's what this court stated.
Can you point me to language? I thought Teach sort of accepted a note. I thought I recalled from Teach language that said the parties admitted it should be strictly construed. And it went on without analysis, I thought. Did I?
Yes. At page 308, the court said in Teach, a taxing statute referring to the employer definition that it was addressing should be strictly construed insofar as it refers to the liability of a person sought to be held subject to the tax. That case was about the imposition of the tax. The second point is that it would only, this dichotomy, if you will, would apply because we're dealing with a tax, and because a tax is treated much differently traditionally. It is one of the ultimate weapons or tools, if you will, of the state. And traditionally, courts have been careful when imposing it and have consistently maintained that when imposing such a tax, a strict construction should be used. Lastly, it maintains, again, harmony with the rest of the statute. If a different interpretation was applied and the division's argument prevailed, there would be conflict with, on the one hand, an employer coming to Colorado, reading the definition of employer, which has not been changed, setting up multiple employer accounts because they each fulfill the definition and could have very good business reasons for doing so. Different lines of business, different management, different locations. We would have that provision plus the provision of 876-103 that says the state must assign. It is not discretionary. They must assign it per employer. And at the same time, without clear words, the division would have the authority to come in and combine those accounts under what we refer to as the benefits sentence to, in essence, create what is in the sentence a pre-existing employing unit. That is why it is appropriate to apply this type of standard. And as we cited in our case, in the Lanasa case out of Louisiana, that is exactly what the highest court in Louisiana held as well, that a distinction needs to be made in this circumstance because of the unique nature of the statute. On the one hand, it provides benefits, but there needs to be a revenue source for that. And it is the General Assembly's obligation to decide how that tax obligation will be imposed and allocated. Therefore, applying it to benefits provides harmony and consistent application of this statute.
Oh, as far as the, I just want to make sure I understand this, as far as whether there's this, it should be construed strictly on the one hand and liberally on the other hand, that's sort of a secondary argument of yours. Your first argument is that it doesn't apply to the taxing statutes, and that it's sort of an alternative position that if it does apply, then you should construe it strictly and it doesn't authorize it?
Perhaps the best way to view it is sort of a concurrent approach. In other words, we believe that the case law is clear that with respect to that part of the statute that imposes the tax, it must be strictly construed. However, even applying a less strict construction, a liberal construction, something less than strict construction, in this case would lead to the same result. And that is because under no rule of statutory construction may words not present in the statute be inserted. There is not even a reference to other words someplace else, which arguably could maybe be.
Is there a place in your argument at all for the notion that it should be construed in two different ways depending upon what your purposes are?
Yeah. Well, yes, Your Honor. When I say concurrent, I mean, on the one hand, strict construction as to the taxes. We're not here today to question at all how the statute should be construed with respect to benefits. And quite frankly, we believe that is exactly what every court that's looked at this, including the Court of Appeals below, has concluded, and that is it was intended for benefits, and for benefits it may be construed liberally. But if you're going to use it as a taxing statute, again, there's no taxing language in the sentence.
But where's the provision that actually levies the tax? I'm having trouble locating the statute section now. Where is that provision that levies the tax on employing units?
First of all, it is not contained anywhere in 870-114. You won't find it there.
Okay, where do we find it?
Secondly, it is contained in the definitional section where it says, first we go to the definition of employer, which we talked about before, which is 870-113, and then in 876-101, it states, taxes shall accrue and become payable by each employer for each calendar year in which he is subject to Article 70-782 of this title with respect to wages for employment. It doesn't say anything about employing units or anything else. It says employers, and it shall. That is my point. That is what the General Assembly has decided, and it is the division's responsibility to follow the law. If they perceive that the statute needs further amendment so that it has a tool available to collapse separate and legally established employer accounts, despite the lack of any transfer and despite the lack of any intent, then they must go to the General Assembly to air that out and for the General Assembly to make a decision. Thus far, the General Assembly has declined to take that step. Lastly, as pointed out by Amicus, and it is important to note in this case, what the division seeks is extremely broad. It seeks the ability to collapse legally established employer accounts, irrespective of whether there's been a transfer of payroll, irrespective of whether there's been any finding of intent to harm the trust fund, irrespective of how distinct and separate the operations may be. It seeks to have this tool, and there are no limits to it, because there is simply 876.114 to grant the authority or to limit the authority. In conclusion, Section 870-114 simply does not provide the words necessary to enable the division to collapse separate and legally established employer accounts for the purposes of assessing a tax. The words do not exist. Its interpretation.
Well, just remind me again, did they create a new account?
Yes.
Well, so they abolished the old accounts?
They abolished four of the five accounts.
Right.
And that's another important part. I'm glad you mentioned that, Justice. In the sentence, the word deemed employed is used. It doesn't say actually employed. Again, another reason why it makes sense for benefits, because you can be deemed employed, and it does no harm to the structure of who you're actually employed for purposes of the statute that says one must employ, report wages per employer. What they did here was literally terminate four accounts, take every employee in those four accounts, move them to the Accord Human Resources account, and actually employ them there. Nobody was deemed employed here. That is a very powerful tool, and one that we submit the General Assembly must consider and state clearly, particularly as in this case, where there are large tax consequences and retroactive tax consequences. Accord was handed a bill that said they owed taxes for 5 years ago, even though they had filed to the letter.
What is the five-year period based on, under their view?
On Section 76-105, and now that question wasn't certified. However, we believe that that provision is not appropriate, and that there is no provision here to go back 5 years at all. That states that you can look back 5 years from the time you were first deemed an employer. Well, that means you could go back 5 years before you existed. The reading of it is nonsensical, and we have submitted all along. It is not a basis to apply anything retroactively. And really, the retroactiveness of this case really speaks to the unfairness and the lack of reasonable notice that should be expected when the state seeks to impose a tax. Finally, the Court of Appeals and the hearing officer got it right. This statute, 870-114, is not a taxing statute. The only way to read it in harmony with the rest of the statute and not do damage to what the General Assembly has carefully crafted is to interpret it for purposes of benefits. In that way, the statute does make sense. And particularly, again, because this is a tax case, we believe that it must be construed, even if at best it's ambiguous, in favor of a court. For the reasons stated here and on brief, Appellee Accord Human Resources respectfully request that this court affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal?
The court has argued that each employer should have its own account under the taxing statutes. And I just want to revisit 876-103, that it says an employer newly subject to CESA is an employer who has never at any time been an employer under CESA. And that's 876-103-3A4. A court already had a tax account. It should have never been able to get additional accounts.
So these additional accounts came into existence when?
Accord's first account was incorporated in Oklahoma, I believe, in 1995. And then Accord HR Colorado came into Colorado in 2004. And Accord HR New York and California, those were all also in the 90s, like 95-ish.
So this was a mistake by the division, right?
That's
right.
A good point, right. I see what you're saying, that, right, the division should have never given them an account.
If that's accurate, then, yeah, it shouldn't have happened in the first place.
Right.
But it did happen.
Right. That's exactly, in my opinion, I think it's the employer's responsibility to know the statutes and to know whether or not it's allowed to have another account and not apply for an account if it's not allowed to have one. But that's why there's a disability to audit employers and to make sure that employers are properly paying their taxes and that they don't have additional accounts that they shouldn't have.
So you say your case really is that the division should be able to correct its own mistake in the interests of the fund in general?
I think to some extent this was the employer's mistake. I think the division has the ability to correct the employer's mistake of applying for a second fund.
The division recognized the accounts. They applied for the accounts they were granted, right?
Right, but it's not always easy for the division to see. In this case, Accord HR and Accord HR Colorado, similar name, okay, maybe they're commonly owned. But it should be the employer's duty to know whether or not they're commonly owned. I mean, that's sort of something that makes sense. Okay, it's not, the division can't always know. If it was Accord HR and...
There's no question that they are commonly owned, right? I mean, we should assume that, right?
Right, the hearing officer found that there's common directors and common direction.
Could you say again, just for one moment, why they weren't entitled to the separate accounts?
Under 876-103-3A4, an employer newly subject to CESA is an employer who has never at any time been an employer under CESA. So Accord was already an employer in 1995, Accord HR, when it applied for a new account, it was the same employer. It was a single employing unit. So it was not entitled to a new account.
Well, said one of the things that the Court of Appeals found was important, and I guess I'd like you to address, you do in your brief, I read it several times, I'm not sure I totally got it, but the difference between, you know, the difference employing unit and also establishments in the same sentence. So,
right.
So I mean, that argument that you just made in response to Justice Coates,
right,
turns on how you define.
Right.
So we're getting into big circular thinking. So tell me why we shouldn't give separate meanings to establishment and an employing unit.
I think, I'm not sure I argued this as clearly as I should have in my brief, but the way I understand it, and I believe the Court of Appeals cites the Winokur case out of Illinois, and I understand that case to say the same thing, is you can't have an employing unit at the same time. You can't be an employing unit at the same time that you're an establishment, okay? So in this case, the Accord entities, they set themselves up as employing units, granted. The employing unit definition is very vague, right? It's any individual who performs services in Colorado. So they set themselves up as employing units, but they should have never been employing units because they are actually establishments. Okay.
A separate establishment.
Right.
Operating. But the common ownership thing was taken out of the statute, you know, many, many moons ago, right?
Right. And
so you're applying criteria that at least statutorily doesn't exist.
Well, the common ownership language was in the statute in 1941, you're right. But it didn't have factors of common control and that sort of thing. And I think that even though it was taken out of the statute, I don't think the common sense factors of ownership and control are out the window. And I think cases around the nation have proven that. They've all applied factors of common ownership and control in applying the single employing unit statute. And even Colorado cases, the Giacopelli case and the Corrin case, those both applied common elements of common ownership and control in determining whether or not the entities were a single employing unit.
Okay, so why are the two different terms used in the same sentence?
Establishment and?
Yep.
I think it's distinguishing that. I have to think about that for a second. I don't have an answer for you. I have to think about it some more, and I'm not able to quite get my head around
sure.
it at the moment. There's been a lot of discussion as to whether this is a taxing statute, the single employing unit statute, and it's not a taxing statute. It has tax consequences, but it's a definitional statute. It says that multiple establishments are a single employing unit. It doesn't say multiple establishments are owed taxes. Even if you strictly construe the single employing unit statute, I think its plain language is clear. All individuals performing services within the state for any of the Accord for an employing unit that maintains two or more separate establishments shall be deemed to be employed by a single employing unit. I think that language is clear.
Counsel, can I just get you to respond to your opposing counsel's argument that essentially the magic language that you're looking for is missing? And I'll just repeat the argument so you can just respond to it. Essentially, that first sentence says employing union means everybody who employs, right? And what should happen next is employing unit also means two or more related entities or establishments. That's your missing sentence, according to the argument. And then the third sentence refers to individuals. Individuals doing da-da-da-da-da. So I'm wondering how do you get around the reference to individuals, if you can just tell me that.
Right. I think the reference to individuals is because the whole Unemployment Act is based around the individuals. You're taxed based on how many individuals you employ, loosely. And benefits are owed based on individuals. And so I think that the reason the statute has a focus on individuals is that the individual is the focus of the act. And that's why it defines single employing unit in reference to individuals.
Then how about the first sentence, though, that actually talks about an employing unit? Here we're going to define an employment unit this way, but it doesn't say combining related entities in any way. Can you address that part?
I think what you're saying is the first sentence says employing unit is, and the second sentence doesn't say single employing unit is.
Correct. It says individuals do blah, 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 blah. So we're thinking individuals, not in what definition of employing unit.
Right. It does say individuals, but it's the blah, blah, blah that matters. It's that they're deemed to be employed by a single employing unit for all purposes of the act. I recognize that it's a little bit strange that in one sentence it says it defines employing unit very clearly, and the next sentence it says it goes more circularly about it, but I don't think that changes what it says.
Does the division have any guidelines that have been used over the years to determine these kinds of issues? I mean, you've invoked the agency deference statutory construction principle, you know, which we can accord or not accord, depending on how we view the statute as a whole, all right? So it's not entirely clear from your argument, right? I mean, you concede that. The agency is supposed to get some deference.
Right.
Correct? So why should we use that canon of construction here? Have you got guidelines? Have you got other cases you can look to where you've combined these accounts when they've mistakenly occurred or anything like that? Policy directives of the director, guidelines for employers to look at, and anything like that?
I think the Teets versus Leach case has the factors, and other courts have applied those factors. I may not be answering your question exactly, so tell me if I'm not. So I think the factors are in the case law.
Well, yeah, I was asking for agency interpretation that you've documented, you know, in some way. You're saying it doesn't exist?
Agency interpretation, yeah, of the single employing
of this statute, yes, for this purpose.
I don't have that. I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but I don't have that.
Thank you very much. I think your time is up. Appreciate it. The case will be submitted on the briefs. I thank both lawyers for their